Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia on this lovely Sunday morning. We are an association of students that work independently and then meet collectively to study the ideas and principles put forward in what we call theosophy, which is ancient wisdom brought forward from time past to our present day. The exemplification in practice of those ideas, we are told, will bring a truer realization of the self and a deeper understanding that brotherhood is a fact in nature, not just the ideal, but that we are all connected and all affecting one another at all times. So that aim, purpose, and teaching, you will find the same at every ULT throughout the world, no matter where situated, and we think there's 28 or 30 lodges by now. And they all have their own study schedules and so forth, but the ideas, the teachings are exactly the same. We hold to the straight lines put down by the representatives of the masters in the late 1800s. So we regard as theosophists all who find themselves engaged in the service of humanity, however they may feel that, however they may accomplish that. There are no rules or beliefs or bylaws, nothing that is set as dogma. Rather, it is left to each individual the independent devotion that one feels in their heart. All are welcome. There is no stipulation of any kind, and we belong in the hearts of all religions, all philosophies, because seeds of truth are planted everywhere, and we are the gardeners. We attempt to be the gardeners. That's our lifetime's meditation. So on Sunday mornings as today, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 until noon. And next Sunday, the topic will be the pitfalls of psychism. And the overall topic for this month is psychism and spirituality. And this morning, we'll hear about meditation in daily life. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class, and currently we are working in The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, and we believe we're coming up on the laws of polarity, which should be very interesting. The book table is open before and after all meetings, and it carries those straight line theosophical teachings that I mentioned at the cost of shipping and printing. No profit is made. And the library, which is a reference library and has more material, more ideas on science and religion and any topic you might find, is open on Wednesday evenings from 5:30 to 7:30, just before the class. And there is someone there to guide you if you have a particular line of study. Because we are autonomous and because we work independently, we similarly depend upon independent contributions as one sees fit in time, work, and money. And any contributions made stay right here in this lodge and try and keep Philadelphia's doors open and lights on, etc. So all help is most appreciated, but you do as you can. So this morning we will have a talk, a forum on the meditation in daily life. Afterwards, we'll have a lot of time for questions and discussion.
Since the dawn of self-awareness, there has been an impulse to transcend the human condition. And nowhere has this impulse been stronger and expressed more creatively than on the Indian peninsula. India's civilization has, since before written history, built its foundation on yoga a quest for transformation, which is central to human life and human evolution. And this history of evolution is the history of yoga and meditation, and they can, for the most part, be considered as one practice. The Sanskrit term yoga is commonly understood to mean union of the individual self with the highest self. Meditation is the means to achieve that union, that bond, that blending. The history of meditation goes back many thousands of years into antiquity itself. As part of the system of yoga, the principles were divinely received by the rishis, those illuminated sages, illumined sages of India, as a means of self-salvation, allowing man a path back to union again with his divine source. These teachings were initially orally passed by word of mouth from one illumined Brahmin priest to another in the form of chants. Thousands in number, these chants or verses form the body of knowledge known as the Vedas, and were later written down, forming part of the most ancient text on earth called the Mahabharata. Archaeological sites in the Indus Valley in India, and datable to 3,000 years before the birth of Christ, reveal figures in a meditation posture used in the system of yoga. So it seems evident that yogic knowledge and meditation have been used for at least 5,000 years. The practice of meditation, combined with service to others and a study of the ancient wisdom, are the cornerstones of the application of theosophy in everyday life. Meditation connects you with your highest self, your body, your Buddhic nature, and a vehicle of the soul and divine spark of the monad or spirit. It is your daily connection to that which connects us all, and a source of much inspiration through the inner wisdom or intuition it brings forth into your life. As is well said in The Light on the Path, the first two steps in true meditation are negative, not positive. They involve a retreat from a position, not an advance into a new position. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. We know that our mind and senses are ill-trained. These steps are meant to reverse that habitual use, and they are shaped into a new direction. Little by little, we begin to see what the positive steps are. That is, the advance into a new condition of mind. The voice of the silence notes that unpraised by men and humble is the mother of all rivers. This simple statement is a sound antidote for the aggressiveness of the personal mind. In time, it will be seen that intervals of silence are as necessary and as fruitful as periods of communication. One can eat in 10 minutes what it takes hours to digest, and which provides energy for still a longer period. Few of us, in the stressful civilization in which we live, are able to realize the great value of silent thought and reflection in the growth of the soul. To consciously consider what has been read studied, or experienced helps assimilate the essence of meaning into the inner nature. The Bhagavad Gita and the notes on the Bhagavad Gita encourage us to see that Krishna and Arjuna are not two separate beings, but the crystallization into words of that soundless, invisible, and continuous self-communion which goes on all the time between our impersonal and personal minds. As we learn to control and purify the latter, the personal mind, this silent dialogue reveals itself as the essence of true being. In this great journey of inner discovery, each man is to himself, absolutely, the way, the truth, and the life. We can learn about Theosophy and the wisdom teachings, study and discuss them at length, as we often do. But it is the practice and application of these teachings that count and make the difference. It is practicing Theosophy, living Theosophy, that will change the world, not just studying the subject. Madame Blavatsky emphasized three important aspects of Theosophy: study, meditation, and service, all in balance. Most Theosophists enjoy the first aspect, study. In fact, many focus almost entirely on it. The second aspect, meditation, gets far less emphasis than it truly deserves. Meditation is the basis of the way to self-realization and more. Edgar Cayce says that meditation is listening to the divine within. Mr. Judge says that to realize in yourself that you are part of the all, that is the constant subject of meditation and will bring the best and most rapid progress. He also said that setting apart a particular time for meditation, a habit is formed, so that the mind will be trained and meditation at that time will become natural. Taking that thought into the silence, inquiring into it, questioning it, examining it in every possible light, and making every effort to penetrate its true meaning, to reach a new and deeper thought, or to receive some intuitional light upon it, that, dear hearts, is meditation. In the attitude of silence, the soul finds the path in a clearer light, and what is elusive and deceptive resolves itself into crystal clearness. Those are the words of Mahatma Gandhi. Once again, the subject for today, meditation and daily life.
Let's just take a moment and drink that in. Wonderful, wonderful ideas. Any thoughts? Yes.
We're always told that concentration is a step towards meditation. So where's, you can't have one without the other, we're assuming.
So concentration, where does that come in? It's interesting that the key to Theosophy says we might consider the word concentrated attention. Because when we hear concentration, it has a certain, oh, we think about doing mathematical problems and centering on something we're not really comfortable with. But if we think of concentrated attention, it calls it an attitude of consciousness. The attitude of consciousness in which its rays are steadily and unintermittently centered upon the thing being done or the subject of study. And it gives a wonderful correspondence of if we were holding a glass and there was a bright sunny day, we could hold it in such a fashion that all the rays would pass through the glass and could actually burn a spot on the ground. That the force of this action being collected and held steady has an actual effect on the outcome. So it concentration is absolutely the first step, learning to get our attitude of consciousness to be attentive, to not pay attention to the distractions of the everyday world. We can't make the dog stop barking or the truck stop rolling by, but we can determine that our attitude will be continuously focused on something for a period of time. We try it, and a little bit at a time, we get better at it. Yes?
Well, the Gita talks about this in great detail, and that this concentration is called single-mindedness. Mm-hmm. And we're being single-minded now, if we're listening to the conversation this morning. And it really just boils down to being present.
Absolutely.
So everything, every moment, which is, easier said than done, of course.
And that is the definition of the word yoga. Union, a complete state of what was just described, a one-mindedness, an equal-mindedness, where, as it was said in the talk, everything that is of a lower terrestrial nature is able to be blended ultimately with the highest within and the highest there is, which again takes a lot of practice, and we can talk about that later. But thank you. Yes?
Is there a difference between prayer and meditation? And if so, could you give us an insight into it?
There would be a difference between prayer and meditation. There would not be a difference between will prayer and meditation. And the only difference there is that the mind is centered and focused and completely desirous in one direction, because we know behind will stands desire. So the will prayer is one which we turn toward the highest. We may fervently desire that the world feel peace, that our brothers and sisters understand they are all interrelated and interconnected. And meditation achieves the same goal. We focus using will on one high ideal, is what we're asked to do in this kind of meditation, and allow that to be completely absorbed in our nature. That desire of the very highest, very most altruistic. So they would have the same outcome on the influence on ourselves, on the world around us, on everything that touched, because we know Theosophy says we are constantly impressing all of the world around us. So will prayer, not the prayer for the selfish nature, I want to win the lottery, please let me win the lottery, but will prayer that focuses on that which is of the highest, most heartfelt nature would be the same process in essence as this kind of meditation. Yes, very back.
A gal named Diane Robinson said that a prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening.
Oh, it's wonderful. A prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening. It's lovely.
Earlier, when the analogy was used of magnifying glass, said that it burns something because the rays of the sun are so focused on that. But when you're using a magnifying glass, it's not just a matter of holding it up, because you have to actually get that little point to focus. If it's very broad, then nothing happens. Is there a corresponding analogy in meditation that helps us, or something that we use to focus our attention?
Yes, absolutely. Theosophy suggests when we begin this practice, first of all, that we do it a little bit at a time. We set up a habit The same time each day, let's start with 15 minutes. We can take 15 minutes out of our day, knowing what we do with the rest of our day, and we should be looking at that. But let's take 15 minutes, fix it at a time where we know we can repeat it daily, whether it's early in the morning, just before bed, whatever it might be. And begin to, as was described, like that magnifying glass, focus down to one point. It's actually called one-pointedness. And Theosophy recommends using an idea of the highest and most heartfelt we can imagine. The idea of brotherhood, the idea of oneness, our conception of what the deific essence is. Whatever it might be, literally, slowly, attentively, with all desire, block out everything until we are down to that one thought. And hold that thought steadily. Now, it talks about, in some of the literature, it talks about the powers of the mind. There are four. The first one is for it to go here, 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 and here, which it will do when we first begin this. We start this process, oh, I forgot to pay the light bill. Oh, I'd like to think about this lovely memory. So we bring it back again. The second power is for it to fly to a pleasant point. Oh, wasn't this a wonderful thing? And again, we're distracted. Third is to fly to an unpleasant point and think about that. The fourth has just gone out of our heads. Give us a second. The fourth. We can't, does anybody know? The fourth is?
Considering not.
Thank you. Considering passiveness, right? Considering not, which is dangerous. So the systems that say close the eyes, empty the mind, relax the body, well, that's lovely for the body, for this vehicle. But this is not the same as a meditative, active concentration on one point. We've probably talked way too long there, yes.
Well, these are the properties of the lower mind.
The lower mind.
The higher
correct.
Mind is distracted by these, but this is the tendency of the lower mind. But I think oftentimes we're asked that if we meditate upon an idea, say for instance, karma, well, that can be very abstract, and our mind can go to aspects of karma mm-hmm. in our life. And as long as we keep on focusing back to the main idea, mm-hmm. that we begin to gather information and insights into ourselves related to that idea of karma. So we examine our world in respect to the idea that we hold. So if the higher the ideal or the idea, the greater, the more abstract we can consider it.
Absolutely. And Theosophy would add to that, start a journal, start a life journal as you begin this process. Because what you will see over time are the small changes in how you're able to handle what life brings to you, where before you would fly off the handle or whatever your typical reaction would be. After some period of this active meditation, the nature is quieted. The faculties of mind are more focused, so we are not so personal in our reaction. So we will see that if we, you know, just note the things, the big things that came up today and how we reacted to them and continue to do that. First of all, we'll see the cycles of them, so we can act on that. And secondly, with concentrated meditation, we may begin to see how that changes that we created. Way in the back.
Meditation, it seems like such a big word to be confined into, you know, one narrow category. What I've been doing for a while is, I guess, more in the Buddhist realm of mindfulness stuff, which is just kind of focusing my attention onto whatever comes into my field of awareness. But it sounds like from a theosophical standpoint, I've been doing it all along. It sounds like I should really just choose that point on which to put my attention.
Well,
and what happens with my mind is that I start to think about it.
Right.
And from my perspective, that thought
is not productive. I mean, that's the same type of thought that happens when I go out in the world. You know, the type of thought I want, which is true creative original thought, only comes when I clear my mind. And I find the only way for me to clear my mind is to kind of just allow things to pass through, to go back to the mindfulness path. So,
okay, let's look at that, though. First of all, you said two opposing things. Actually, you said you focus on whatever comes into your mind. And then you also said things pass through my mind. So in two different postures, and we're not picking on you, this is part of the process, we have two different postures. We have a focused attention and we have a passivity. So the danger perhaps in a method like that might be that we start out wanting focus and holding attention and watching what comes in, and we wind up watching things come and go. And at that point, we have changed the nature of what we're doing to become passive to the influences of whatever happens to float through our mind. And we know all kinds of things are floating around in the astral to which we are subject. So we think the method described is in the right direction, in that a focused, beginning with a focused attention, clearing the noise, and a focused attention. Theosophy would just say, rather than grab an idea that floats in, create the thought that you will pay attention to. So it is something from within, of a higher nature. Just think about love. Think about, these are all abstract ideas, but consider brotherhood. Consider the deific principle. Take one of the fundamentals and just begin to literally pare it down to its essence. We are one. Whatever that means to you, that will begin to engulf. It just pours from within outwards, as opposed to letting things fly by. That is more an expression of passivity, and we're sure that's not what you meant, but it was a good example for the class. Did you want to follow up?
The only follow-up is that, again, when I put my attention on one thing, then I start to think. And to me, that's the opposite of what meditation is.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking is my own repetitive pattern, you know, perceptions from the past. I mean, I know there's a different type of thinking, which is what you're talking about. It's what comes from within out, and that's what, you know, I seek in my meditation. I apologize. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But, so I guess I don't know if there's any theosophical points that help you stop thinking in the point of focused attention. Because I need to get out of the focused attention in order to stop thinking.
It's interesting. What you brought up is actually in the teachings that we were studying. One of the first things when you begin this practice that will pop up is memory. It is something that is accessed when you begin this. And I was shocked to read that, but it said that in a theosophical article, that one of the first things that will come up is memory. That's a distraction. This is something which is something the mind can fly to, as we talked about earlier. So yes, some of those thoughts will get in the way. But what you described is simply, you're in the right direction, you just need to practice it over and over again. The more we push away the unwanted thoughts, eventually that will happen on its own. It's like, in a very terrestrial example, building muscles. The more we work and repeat and tone, the better then stronger that muscle becomes, so that when we lift something heavy, it is without effort in a sense. It's a strange analogy, but what you described is the right path. Focusing, picking an idea, trying to ignore what comes to your mind, and just the more you do that, the easier it will become. Your hand was up before.
Well, the mindfulness is what we all try to achieve. But mindfulness of what? I mean, are we just mindful of what comes to us? Or are we mindful of what we are in the presence of that and what's observing it? You know, everyone that meditates will say that our minds are flooded with extraneous thoughts. And there's the meditation. Where's that thought coming from? why is, you know, I mean, there's a whole kinds of higher conversation you can have with yourself about that, but you always bring it back to a central idea.
Absolutely.
There's always a point where you bring your mind back, but otherwise, as you said, the lower mind will be distracted.
And what that alludes to is what we said earlier. It's actually in the teachings also. What are you doing with the other 23 and a half hours of your day? If your lifetime is scattered and fragmented and distracted and pulled here and pulled there, which necessarily we are to a certain degree in this period in our evolution, if we're in the working population or family life or whatever it might be, we have a lot going on. We're in the Kali Yuga. There's a lot of fast activity, but there is also opportunity. So part of what was described was getting a better hold of how we are thinking in the rest of our day. If we are totally concerned with ourselves and what happens to us and how it makes us feel, we're not focused. We are turning to the lower and making it harder than when we sit and try and look away from that. If we are mindful, as was said, in at least some of the other parts of our day, then when we sit for meditation, the mind says, oh, I know what that is, and can better reach that. And then our goal, obviously, is to walk through life as one who is here to help and do service where needed, to practice duty, to recognize duty and finish it, to thereby work through our karma, and just to seek to render gentle service. If we can walk through life with that as our intention and deal with the times where we fall off the path, but refocus, then when we sit down to meditation, this is a natural practice, because we've been working on it throughout our day. Your hand was up.
Yeah, a few minutes ago, the chair used the phrase, focus the faculties of our mind. And the faculties of our mind, it's we've heard the powers of the mind. I think what was said earlier is like tendencies of the lower mind.
The lower mind.
Powers of the mind are what? Imagination,
will,
thought, memory, and feeling. Mm-hmm. And what plays in, what could play in, and can be very helpful to focus, is using your imagination. Because we have to be attracted to the object of our meditation so that we're not distracted by other extraneous stuff. One way to do it is, if you know a lot about, think of the idea of evolution. If you happen to know a lot about the gestation of an embryo, bear the thought in mind, evolution, and focus your attention on watching the embryo evolve from the seed to the human being, or focus your attention on watching the flower bloom, mm-hmm. and make it your favorite color, and that'll mm-hmm. keep your attention. Or focus on watching the sun rise and bearing in mind certain implications
Absolutely.
Of evolution. So,
Absolutely.
Yes, so use the faculties. We think that just saying, I'll meditate on brotherhood, kind of abstract, don't know where my mind's going to go. Where am I going to go with that? You've got to be able to focus the faculties of the mind on something.
Mm-hmm. And what was described are all expressions of from within outward. So we start with that high ideal, that everything blossoms from within outward, and we see the lotus blossoming, and we see the sun rising, and all the things that were described. So whatever that is for your mind, absolutely concentrate on that. Thank you. A hand was here. Yes.
Obviously, the problem of distraction, we're trying to focus, that's one method. There are different ways, and one that came that I experienced with somebody is if you need to focus on something and you have all these thoughts coming in, picture the sky with clouds, and the clouds are your thoughts, and you watch the clouds go by, and your thoughts are going by. Don't focus on the thoughts, but focus on the blank space between the sky behind the clouds. And you are able to blank out your mind, and it enables you to focus on that thing you want to focus on, like your flower or your brotherhood or whatever your focus of your meditation is. But the method of watching clouds is a wonderful method to just blank out your mind to be ready for that focus of your meditation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. As long as we're not doing it passively, but as was described, actively
active.
Preparing for.
You see your thought, you know what the thought is, and it's sort of, you encapsulate it, it's a cloud, it
mm-hmm.
moves by.
Mm-hmm.
You don't focus on that thought. You know it's there, you let it go.
So the mind is active in that.
Because
mm-hmm.
you want to blank out the mind so you can fully concentrate on that whatever it is you want to meditate on.
Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry, the lady in the back had her hand up.
Part of this discussion that's so fruitful is a basis that although we are spiritually all one, we're using physical and astral senses that are limited according to karma. So it would be helpful also to us to figure out, when we learn something, when we take something in, are we more visual, or are we more auditory, are we more motion-centered, kinesthetic, and sometimes quieting the body and beginning this process means using the physical sense that we've made dominant through karma, and then using that as a trigger, a sound, a sight, a piece of poetry, a sacred book. And for each of us, the starting point may be different, the process might be different, but the overall goal and oneness is the same.
Man, know thyself.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, yes.
Well, we've often heard many times, or we remember the term, duty is the talisman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it would seem that if we understand the meaning of the talisman, and that duty is the talisman, when we wake up in the morning and get ready for the day, and we begin to think about it, when you mentioned focus, focus is, what is my duty to others and myself in respect to that? And this unity which we study in the fundamentals, the aim, the purpose, and the teaching, then we fix our minds on carrying out our duty, whatever it is. The problem is that we are thrown offline by everything that comes in at us. So in order to have a good focus, you have to have a good basis. You have a telescope up and want to focus on the heavens. Many people realize that you have to stand there for a while till the telescope stops shaking. And then you can focus. So it would seem that what is my myself with others in mind.
That perfect statement is the description of the lifetime's meditation. There, what we've been talking about is an active practice for each of us individually. There is also, as above, so below, etc., there is also the lifetime's meditation where, in that sense, we wake up and our first question would be, what is my duty to myself and the world today? Where do I need to concentrate my lifetime's efforts to be of service to all? And it may start out with something of a lesser nature. My lifetime's meditation may be to learn to become the best parent I can, or the best neighbor I can, or the best artist I can, whatever it is that is focused upon. But as we go through lifetimes of learning, the ultimate goal, the life's meditation, would be, as I begin each day, how can I best serve all of life around me? What is my duty? How will I use these spiritual powers that I am so gifted to have, as is all of my brothers and sisters? So there's also the lifetimes meditation to think about. And at the end of our physical life, the collective direction will be what our lifetimes meditation was. Maybe it was greed. Maybe it was competition. Maybe it was love. Maybe it was service. Whatever it is, we are creating it by the way we are going through every minute of our day. And to make that higher and permanent requires our effort. So there is that first step of the individual meditation and the carrying over with effort to the lifetime meditation. Yes.
You keep using the statement, whatever we will it to be. When we say we will it to be, mm-hmm. is that some power within us that we can use, or we do use it, or we misuse it?
The prime factor in the guidance of thought is will. This is from a Theosophical article. Without that, all else is useless. Will and desire are behind everything. Even if we were completely passive, we have decided to be completely passive. It's a ridiculous example, but we are forever using and putting into motion through our desires the will to create whatever it is that is before us. We can't believe we were the creators of it. But if it's before us, it must be ours. I can't chew another's food or read a book for another and then have the one take the test. It doesn't make any sense. So the real meaning of contemplation, the prime factor in the guidance of thought, is will. To be efficient for the purpose, it must be not only a passing resolution of the moment, a single fierce desire of short duration, but a settled and continued strain as nearly as can be continued and concentrated without one single moment's remission. That is will in action, and behind will stands desire. So we first must want to sit and begin this, or to think and begin this process. We are able because we are the creators. Yes.
What about the use of props in meditation?
Props? I'm sorry. Uh-huh.
Like a candle, put the lights out, background music, crystal to concentrate on?
Perhaps if it helps in the beginning, but we don't think we would need it after a while, a candle is a wonderful symbol. We want to make sure we don't fall asleep and have the candle still burning or so forth, but just... let's take the image of that candle, that flame, and put it in our mind and consider that it never actually touches the wick. It sits higher, unaffected by what's going on below it. The wax and the wick and everything else are changed. So that image of that flame is the higher within us. And as we begin to understand that, that image of the flame may fade or may get stronger, but it's a help in the beginning. But we don't want to rely upon anything outside, because this is a process of turning within. So take any of those things that we think might help and image them. Make them part of this process. Soon you won't need them. Yes?
In reading, you often find that fasting accompanies meditation, especially among the great souls. There was Jesus in the cave fasting. There was Prophet Muhammad. He fasted and meditated. And also the Buddha. Did you find anything in your studies or in your research that addressed that idea of that
process?
That process.
Right. The fasting process. We read one sentence and we can't put our eyes on it, but it was simply this. Fasting is fine unless one needs to eat. Literally, it was something along those lines. Do not fast if one needs food. So it is completely dependent upon the vehicle that one has. Same thing with vegetarianism. Eat meat if you need, if your vehicle needs meat to act and perform better. Don't eat meat if your vehicle can do without it. It's completely dependent on what one is working with at that moment. So we didn't read anything about fasting making the process go more smoothly, but we imagine if we have rid ourselves, in a sense, of all the external, including food, and if we cannot think about being hungry, it may be a way to center the mind and concentrate. It is part of a number of practices, but what it said here was, again, take care of the outer vehicle so that we can turn within and not be distracted by it. Yes?
Well, it's our understanding that HPV, in speaking to different groups, mentioned the fact that theosophy was brought to the West, and that no one in the West is of the nature of the Asian or the Indian, and that we just simply do not have the makeup for the practices that go on in the East. However, if you notice in every lodge, there's a library, a book table. And if we would understand ourselves and what the duty is, then reading, study, questions that we ask, service to others, and it's sort of a humility, a calmness, a patience.
Absolutely.
And under our circumstances today, with the internet and everything else, that doesn't appear to be concentration. And many, at the end of the day, it's difficult to quiet our minds. It's been here, there, and everywhere.
Right.
But the library, in front of the building, the book table. And we're mentioning certain practices which do not fit the Western.
Absolutely. And as you were bringing up that point that the Western Constitution is very different from the Eastern, fasting is, in a sense, a sacrifice. So what comes to mind is Raj or Raja Yoga. Yoga was mentioned earlier, and there are two basic overlaying types, Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga. And the ultimate goal is the same, but the method and influence differ greatly. And Theosophy recommends Raja Yoga, which requires no physical postures, but deals with the inner man whose fears lie in the world of thought. And it is, in a sense, a sacrifice of oneself to help another, put oneself in a position where they wish to be of active service, to render gentle service to another, with the highest ideal placed before oneself, and to strive incessantly to rise up to it. So it's an active yoga practice to be equal-minded of desire and will and purpose, sacrifice something of ourselves for another, which again puts us in the same position perhaps as the fasting, the giving up of something that one is used to, and concentrates that will, helps to concentrate that will.
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of yoga, but Hatha being one, and Krita yoga.
Okay, we didn't know how many.
Kundalini yoga, and there's several. And what it and what the teachers warn is that these arouse, even though you say the name of God over and over mm-hmm. and over, and you elevate your mind, you awaken the lower nature, and that's why a lot of things happen, and that. The one thing that in the West we have no real control over is our moral nature. And it arouses it, and it only makes for problems in our life. Where Raj Yoga, you do not go there. You stay at a high level and you come down into mm-hmm. your lower nature. You don't have your lower nature come up into your higher nature because you're dealing with all that lower thoughts and feelings and tendencies that we've built up, and we have a ferocious battle on our hands.
Absolutely, and we come into life with it anyway. We don't need to strengthen it, make it more difficult for ourselves. But it tells us the first requisite for Raja Yoga is thorough purity of heart, purity of thought, of word, of deed. These are the essentials of one who would rise above the ordinary level and join the gods. So again, if we are attuning our mind and following our nature towards that which is higher and altruistic and loving and for the betterment of all, we are honoring that higher within. We are accessing it in a very active way, so that when we sit for quiet meditation, that's another kind of meditation, the active meditation in the world and the way we use our lives. But that quiet meditation, then we have set that channel clearer to that which we are trying to access. Yes.
Well, there's two books that we have in our library that are very helpful in understanding Raja. And in our daily practice, the Bhagavad Gita is the songs of Orpheus, and that there's the basis of all that we've talked about this morning. That we, if we put into practice, we become more of what we want to be.
Absolutely.
And Patanjali is yoga aphorisms. It's all about Raja Yoga.
Absolutely. The greater the purpose, the lesser will all give way to become blended into one universal feeling, the only true and holy, the only unselfish and eternal one, love, an immense love for humanity as a whole. It is that kind of perception where we don't see each other as separate, but blended as one unit, one expression of spirit, and that love that we project and swim in and express is felt by all. We know there are people who walk in a room and we feel better right away. That's an active effort to bring forth that spirit which is within and allow it to be expressed, because as we're working through the distractions of the lower, it is quietly sitting, unaffected, waiting for us to reach up. And reaching up is what we need to do. Yes?
This emphasis on altruism is so very important,
mm-hmm.
That we initially we were asking about the difference between prayer and meditation.
Yes.
And often prayer is something, we want something for ourselves. And meditation definitely is not something we want something for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story about a young concert pianist who was entering a competition, and she was all nervous, and she went talked to her teacher, who was also a meditation teacher or a guru or something, and said, I can't do it. And he said, you've done enough practicing. Don't practice anymore. And just go and meditate, and you'll be fine. And she said, okay, I'll meditate on winning my competition. And she said, he said, no, you meditate on losing the competition. she played so beautifully, she won.
She got that out of the way.
To just get your ego away from it.
And really what's described is attachment. The attachment to the act was causing her so much distress, as we might feel when we first begin this process. The attachment to, I can't possibly sit still and quiet for any length of time. I can't do it. I'm attached to this world of the senses. But we are also within that which is quiet and still and spiritual and the essence, the reflection of the essence of all. Yes?
The first paragraph of the Declaration of ULT, we hear it every time we come to Lodge, and sometimes we carry it with us in our pockets to read when we have a moment. Over and over again. But have we really concentrated? Have we really put our mind onto the terminology, the wording, the sentences? It would seem that that's a good place to begin, so that we concentrate on every single phrase and word.
In independent devotion, we think would be,
right. In other words,
the main.
We say the words over and over again, but do we spend time when it's quiet?
Right.
What does that mean?
Right.
What is my understanding of the term?
Exactly, and we are the only ones who can cause anything to be. We must do it ourselves. By the way, there are two excellent articles on meditation and concentration in a pamphlet called The Inner Man by William Q. Judge, and it's on the book table if you would like to see it. We have time for one more. Yes?
For years, I was beating myself up in my meditations for my thoughts moving around so much, but I've developed peace with that in the last couple of years, and you helped me out with a statement that you said earlier, because what happens is that with the craziness of everyday life, I'm not capable of processing everything mindfully. And so in the first 20 minutes or so of every meditation, there's this process that's happening where all the thoughts are coming in, but I'm able to process them mindfully. And then that clears out the space so that perhaps in the second half of the meditation I can get into the more focused attention.
Wonderful.
So I don't know.
Wonderful. That's you've swept away the dust that has collected on the mirror and now can be reflected, that which is within. So you're doing the first process of sweeping out those thoughts and those things that need attention, and then centering oneself. And
if I actively try to sweep them out, that becomes suppression. I believe that they're just going to still stay there. So I think that I actually have to allow them to come in. And what the statement that helped me out is that, karmically, everything that comes to me is something that I have created in some way. So in essence, maybe it's not that passive, maybe accepting what's going to come to me, even the sounds, the thoughts, the emotions, the interactions. But I have to be careful, because I've gotten very good at justifying my behaviors with new knowledge, so I have to be careful with that.
And what was stated was, since what has come to me is mine, I have created it, I also have the power to preserve it or to destroy it and replace it with something better. Those are within my and every one of our grasp. And we just want to finish with a short reading from The Voice of the Silence. Self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. Here's the part for meditation. Fix thy soul's gaze upon the star whose ray thou art, the flaming star that shines within the lightless depths of ever-being, the boundless fields of the unknown. Have perseverance as one who doth forevermore endure. Meeting adjourned.